Welcome to episode number 19 of the WIM podcast. That's W-W-I-M podcast, Women Who Inspire Me. My guest today is the beautiful, talented, caring, heroic Penny Smith, aka Hospice Nurse Penny. Thank you so much for being a guest.
Thanks for having me on. I don't know if I would say I'm heroic. I'll take the other stuff.
Nurses are the number one heroes to me, without a doubt. I mean, so what led you down this journey? What, you know, in your, you know, where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in Washington State mostly. My dad was in the military.
Yeah.
And as far as what led me to hospice nursing, So earlier in my life, I did many, many things. I was a bartender. I worked at a vet. I worked in factories. I had many different jobs. And I was also a drug addict and an alcoholic. Oh, wow. And I ended up going to jail. And I gave my son from my first marriage to his dad to raise when he was four so that I could party. But I finally, when I was in my late 20s, kind of started to get my life back on track. I went through treatment, got sober, and remarried, had a couple of daughters, eventually got my son back. And 10 years into our marriage, we decided that we wanted to get a divorce. We just were not getting along. And we just kind of both decided that we needed to divorce. I had been a stay-at-home homeschooling mom at that point because he was in the military, so he deployed often. So I knew that I needed to do something. So I looked in the newspaper and I saw that nurses were being hired a lot in the newspaper. So I thought, oh, nursing sounds good. You know, I used to work at the vet. I was a vet assistant for a while, so I could probably be a nurse. And so I decided to go to nursing school. And I knew that I wanted to do something that I felt was service work to kind of make amends for my past, you know, to kind of retribution, I guess you could say. And not that all nursing isn't service work. It definitely all is. But I had had an experience with hospice because my soon-to-be ex-husband at the time, my stepmother-in-law had died about a year before on hospice. She had cancer and she died on hospice. So I recognized that the work they did was really sacred.
Right.
And I wanted to kind of go in that direction. I also had death anxiety, very, very much fear of death.
Okay.
And
wow.
I thought, if I expose myself to it, like exposure therapy, that will help. And so I really decided that's what I wanted to do. I started off as a licensed practical nurse. And I didn't think that licensed practical nurses could work in hospice. I thought you had to be an RN for that. So I figured, well, I'll start off as an LPN because we just wanted to get the divorce.
Also, does that also stand for lower paid nurse?
Lower paid nurse. Yeah. Yes, definitely. Yes. Less. Let's see. What's another word for respected that starts with a P? They get shit on a lot. You know,
yes.
Like people are like, they're not real nurses. Absolutely.
But they are.
Absolutely are real nurses. I worked really hard. The nursing program for LPN was very, very hard.
Of course.
So I went to work in a family practice clinic and I worked there for a year. And then I decided that I should start kind of going into a hospital and get more hands-on patient care experience, and then was going to go to school and become an RN so that I could work in hospice. So I'm working at this family practice clinic, moved to the hospital, and I start seeing this hospice care center, brand new hospice care center opening up in the neighborhood. And I thought, okay, well, that's where I'm going to work. You know, I'm going to get my RN and then I'm going to go work there. Well, they lay off LPNs from hospitals about every 10 years. It's a cycle where they go, yeah, we don't need any LPNs after all. We're going to lay them all off. So 3 months into my hospital career as an LPN, I got laid off. And I thought, well, you know what? I should just go ahead and apply or see if they have any positions for LPNs at the hospice house. And they did. And they hired me. And so that was kind of really how I got into hospice nursing, and then did get my RN eventually and my bachelor's, and moved through the hospice world, and now I've been pretty much in hospice for 20 years up
And you
until
recently
Tuesday.
retired, correct?
I retired. Yeah, Tuesday was my last
Congratulations.
day. Thank you. Yeah.
When you said I'm going to be a hospice nurse, did your fear of death just kind of go out the window? You just kind
Yeah, I mean, it did. Be becoming a hospice nurse really helped that fear of death in different ways. One, just being exposed to it often and just acknowledging that everybody dies. You have to accept it because it's inevitable. And then also, part of my fear was rooted in not having any concept of afterlife. I wasn't raised with religion. I didn't believe in heaven or hell. I still don't. And so, I had a fear of after we die that there's nothing else. And working in hospice and seeing people deathbed visioning, where they're seeing their deceased loved ones and even pets, has, helped me to form a belief that there is an afterlife.
There's something,
So that really helped with that anxiety. I never, I'd never seen a dead body before I went into it. I had no expectations really going into it. I didn't know what to expect. And seeing the dying process and watching people go through like the same things when they're dying a natural death, was just fascinating to me. There was just something about it that just helped me feel more comfortable with the idea that, it's going to happen.
What were some of those first experiences when people were seeing people that had passed? Like, initially, did you dismiss them or?
No, I didn't, because I worked with a hospice nurse guru who had been, my mentor. And so she explained things to me along the way. And honestly, I can't even remember the first time that I saw somebody visioning and my reaction to that. I remember the first time that I saw somebody who a nun had told me the spirit had left the body and the body was here doing the work of dying. I remember that distinctly. But I don't remember the first time I saw somebody visioning. I couldn't tell you, like, I remember different people that were visioning. I remember clearly, some of the things that people told me that they saw, but I don't remember the first time that I ever saw that happen.
And when you started as a hospice nurse, was it something, did you like immediately say, this is my calling, this is what I picked the right thing, or did it take time to get used to, or?
I knew right away. I knew
That's
right
great.
away.
That's
Yeah, I
great.
knew it. I was like, yeah, this is it. This is the fit for me. And it was a sad story. So I'm working at this hospice care center, which, by the way, is like in your face, death and dying every single day. Like, people go there basically to die. And so I'm working there and I'm going to school at the same time to get my RN, because I still want
And
to be an RN.
staying sober. Wow. So you had a
Yeah.
lot.
Well, no, I wasn't. I wasn't. I wasn't staying sober. That's a whole other story. I'm
Oh my
sober
goodness. Well,
now,
we'll have
but
to, okay. We'll maybe we'll
we'll
backtrack
circle back to that.
to
Yeah, so I'm going back to school because I'm also aware that LPNs are hired in hospice sometimes, but like the LPN positions aren't as common as RN positions. And plus, I wanted to make more money. So I'm going back to school this whole time, and my manager is saying, like, yeah, go to school, we'll hire you, we'll hire you. And after 5 years of working there, I get my RN, and they tell me that the policy is that I have to have 3 years of experience as an RN before they can hire me in hospice. And I was just crushed. I was devastated. Like, this whole time you said you would hire me, and now you're not going to hire me. What else am I going to do? I don't know what else I can do, And people that I worked with said, you'd be great in the ER. I'm very, fast paced. And working in a hospice care center is not, you're not sitting around holding people's hands and singing Kumbaya. It's very, very busy. It's like an ICU. These are acute care patients. The end result is different, The focus of the care is different, but it is acute care. And we're doing all kinds of things on them, starting infusions and giving medications and wound care and just all kinds of things. So I was very fast paced. And so I thought, okay, I'll go to the ER. I went to the ER. I was there for 3 months. I absolutely hated it. I went home crying every night. I couldn't stand it. And fortunately, there was another hospice care center that was about a 45-minute commute from my house, and they hired me. So I was able to stay in hospice after that, or get back into it after that.
So while you start, you said when you started school, you were drinking or using drugs or both or
No. So when I was 27, I went through treatment and I got off drugs and got off alcohol. And when I was like in my early 30s, 31, I think I married my second husband, who was what we call a normie. And so he could drink occasionally or not, no big deal. And I was sober for 8 years. And after 8 years, with my life now completely back on track, I'm good mom, I'm a stay-at-home mom, I've got my son back in my life and everything's good. And I start thinking, maybe I'm not an alcoholic. And I went to a swimming pool. We lived in Okinawa, Japan. And yeah, my ex-husband was in special forces.
So you
So
moved.
yeah, so we moved to Japan. So I go to the pool one day and there's an American woman there who's a drug and alcohol counselor. And I'm talking to her about, like, I used to drink. I'm sober for 8 years. And she goes, yeah, we don't really, there's a kind of a new model around quitting alcohol. And alcohol really was my drug of choice. I mean, I did other things, but alcohol was the biggie. And she said, we really try to lean more towards moderation. And
Functionality,
then if you can't moderate, then you quit, right? And so I was like, oh, well, that's really interesting. And meanwhile, my husband's always questioning how I'm an alcoholic when I don't drink alcohol. So I was like, how are you an alcoholic if you don't even drink alcohol? So I go home that day from the pool and check the mail, and there's a magazine in there, and it's from like it's Time or I don't know what magazine it was, but on the cover it had the story about how European countries are more successful in treating alcoholism because they don't do abstinence first. They do moderation.
You're getting signals.
Right.
It
I'm like, you're supposed to
was
be drinking.
weird.
So I thought about it a lot. I talked to my family, I talked to my husband, I talked to my friends, and I finally was like, you know what? I'm gonna just try it and see what happens. And so I drank and I didn't get drunk. And it was fine. And I became like this person who could drink socially once in a while. And it was no big deal. And I did it for years. And then we got divorced and I met my current husband, who was a functional alcoholic. And the two of us together were like party hardy all the time. And so we tried all the time. We tried all the things to manage the drinking. Nothing worked. We would quit for a few months, or 6 months was the longest, and we just couldn't do it. Like, we just tried everything. And finally, when we just so COVID happened, and we decided that we were going to take an he was going to take an early retirement. Well, we sheltered in place at our cabin, and our cabin is like this party place for us. It's like drink every day. We were able to really manage functionally for a long time because he worked nights and I worked days. And the only time we drank was on the weekends, and we never drank when
So
we were.
it seemed normal.
Yeah, we didn't drink when we were together. I always drank too much when I drank, but so anyway, we had made a decision to move to our cabin, to sell the house and move to the cabin, and he was going to take an early retirement. It was kind of like we decided that we cannot continue to drink because the cabin's our party place. We will drink every day and we'll kill ourselves with alcohol. Also, the income is going to change because he's retiring. We can't afford it. And so we just made the decision to just do it. And we both quit. And in October, it will be 5 years that we've been sober.
Congratulations.
Yeah,
It's
thanks.
alcohol is so weird. I just celebrated 30 years without drinking.
Wow.
I only drank between the ages of 19 and 21, but the amount of drinking and trouble I got in those 2 years was like
That's
a lifetime.
incredible to quit at that young of an age and to maintain your sobriety for that long. That's
It's and the weird thing is, I think of myself now as a 51-year-old, and I'm like, well, emotionally, so many things in my life are better than they were back then that my brain wants to trick me into thinking I could drink and be fine. But I know if I had one and fine, then eventually I'd go off the deep end. So.
fortunately, neither one of us have that, like we could probably, like we both know, like
You know, that's
there's
well, that's
no
the
way.
thing is, I know too. Like,
Yeah, we don't even entertain it. And the first couple of years was hard. It's hard to be a couple and to get sober together. The odds aren't very good. And I sometimes thought, are we ever going to have fun together again? Or is this it? We're just never going to have fun because our life was, we met at a party, that was our deal. We drank together. We always had fun drinking. And now, we have a blast. I mean, both of us are so, we talk about, recently we were talking about how great it is that we don't drink. We have some neighbors down the way that are alcoholics. They're drunk all the time
And
and
you're
they're
like, thank God that's
unhealthy.
not us.
Yeah. They're younger than we are and they're in terrible physical shape. And we're like, man, we are so happy to not drink, and we have so much fun. We play Scrabble and we laugh our asses off. And the first time that happened, I remember thinking to myself, wow, we're laughing so hard, we're both crying, and we're not drinking alcohol.
That's awesome. Did you notice a difference in your work?
Sorry. No, it didn't impact my work at all. So when I did patient care, it did not impact my work. I didn't call in. Well, once in a while, I would call in sick with a hangover.
That's what I meant. More not while that you were
Yeah.
drunk while you were working.
No,
Just
never did that.
did it
Never did
affect?
that. And never went back to drugs ever. Never, like never, ever. But yeah, once in a while, I would call in sick from being hungover. But otherwise, it didn't affect my work. That's why it was so hard for us to quit, because it didn't affect our work.
Because
We
you
were
were able to
functional.
function. You weren't getting locked up or handcuffed or any of that. So that's, that's what kept happening to me. I kept getting handcuffed, sent to the ER, sent to rehab, and I was like, I don't like I gotta stop this. And the second time I was in rehab, there was like a 30 something year old or 40 year old, and he's like, this is my seventh time in rehab. And I was like, I never want to say that. And the only way I can never say that again is if I stop. And I did.
Well, yeah, I had the same type of experience, bad one time waking up in a car with two men, one on either side of me. I'm in the front seat, we're going across the trestle, and I'm just like, what the hell is
What
going
is
on
you're right?
here?
Oh my God.
Pull the car over. They wouldn't pull it over. They wouldn't let me out. I grabbed the steering wheel, put us into a guardrail. The cops came. I slapped somebody. I think maybe the cop, I don't know, maybe the driver. He was trying to accuse me of driving. He was underage.
Jeez.
And I went to jail, and it wasn't the first time I'd been to jail. I had been other times too. And yeah, so that's why, like, at that age, 27, I was clear to me that I had a problem. Like, I'm getting coke every night. It's like, this is a problem. But the second time around, it was like, I drink a lot, I get drunk, I'm hungover, I don't like it, but whatever, it's fine. I'll quit for the whole week while he's at work, and then we'll be fine. It wasn't as easy to identify that there was a problem. But we did start having some like arguing more towards the end. That was kind of another thing that was going on with
My
us that we were.
drinking me, I have Crohn's disease. So
Oh.
drinking beer would just be horrible on my Crohn's. But I'm like 19, 20, 21. I'm just like, oh, this is what I gotta deal with. Like, I didn't think, you idiot, what you're doing to your body, So you recently published a book.
Yes.
Can you
My
tell me
book
about
is.
that whole process and what put that in idea in your head and
Yeah. So I started writing. Let me look and see if I
It's
got it right.
Influencing Death, correct?
Influencing Death, Reframing Dying for Better Living. just start. Oh, I got one over here.
Okay.
I just got my studio kind of set up. It's still a little bit of mess in here, but yeah, it's called nice. Influencing Death, Reframing Dying for Better Living. And
wait,
I started
hold it up again. I want to get a screenshot.
Yeah.
Hold on. Got it. Awesome.
So I started writing stories when I started working in hospice because I was so fascinated by everything that was happening.
Yeah.
I just, for my own sake, loved creative writing and started writing these stories. And probably about 2018 or so, I started thinking about writing more. And I found this website that Amazon had that had formatting for screenplays, and you could write a screenplay and they would pick amateurs to make these into shows.
Right.
And so I took my stories and started writing them into this screenplay. And then probably about a year later, I'm just doing it once in a while, but Amazon stopped it. They were like, we're not going to do this anymore. So I'm like, oh crap. So I tabled it. And then I found my way to TikTok. So in 2020, during the pandemic, I got onto TikTok. Hospice Nurse Penny. I didn't plan on, I was Nurse Penny to start. I changed it to Hospice Nurse Penny later, but I didn't plan on talking about hospice. I was kind of doing the little trendy stuff, fun stuff, you know, funny stuff. But I'm old at the time. I was in my late 50s. And I was just kind of playing around, you know, didn't expect very many people to watch my videos. And then one day I decided to tell a story about a hospice patient and it went viral. And all of a sudden I had like 10,000 new followers overnight. I was like, oh, okay. So I've always been passionate about end of life care. I am a passionate advocate for hospice. I firmly believe that people should be educated about death, that the more that we normalize it, the better a death Absolutely. A person can have.
It's so funny because, you know, back in the day, they wouldn't even say the word cancer, right? They would say the cancer or the C word. Like, and it's like the less you talk about it, the more it's like Voldemort. You give it more power if you don't talk about it, correct?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, especially around the death anxiety too.
Right.
And so then people were saying to me, you should write a book. And I was also sharing my sober journey at the time too, because in October of 2020, I made this announcement. I had 100,000 followers by that point, and I was like, I'm getting sober, because I felt like the accountability would help me, which it did. And so people were, you know, wanting to know my story and telling me I should write a book. And I thought, all right, maybe I should do that. And after a while, it made sense to me to go ahead and give it a shot. So yeah, I wrote the book. It's a memoir and it's about my life, what led me to hospice nursing and how my earlier years helped me to be a better hospice nurse, and how being a hospice nurse and taking care of the dying really helped me to live my life better.
And so what would you say are like three big lessons that you learned as a hospice nurse, or life lessons that, you know, you want people to know, like, you know, talking about death,
that is important. So I want people to know that not talking about it doesn't mean that it's not going to happen. and if you do talk about it, it's not going to make it happen faster. Right. And that if you talk about it, you are able to, you know, first of all, if you have a fear around death, you're able to put that aside, because the more you talk about it, like you say, the Voldemort thing, right? You take the power away from it. And, you know, we're always going to fear the unknown. And so the more you know about it, the less you're going to fear it. You know, it's something that you can just be like, oh, just put that aside. And you get to that place of acceptance. And that's when you don't have fear about death anymore. Also, it's important to talk about it so that people know what you want when you're dying. If you are in the position to be on hospice, What kind of music do you want playing? What kind of environment do you want? Do you want to be on life support? Do you want them to do everything to prolong your life no matter what? Or do you want to have a peaceful, natural death when the time comes? I think those are the really important takeaways. That death is just, it's not to be feared. It's just, it happens to everyone, none of us are going to get out of here alive.
Nope.
And
My grandfather passed away when I was 9, and I don't remember this, but apparently, after all the services and everything were done, they found in a lockbox all his requests. But how he
gosh.
wanted everything done was found afterwards.
Yeah, you can't do
You got to tell
things
someone
for
where that
people
is.
if they don't know what want to have them do. Yes, exactly. It's important to be able to talk about. And when you are able to just accept, you don't have to like embrace death, but you can accept it. People ask me, are you afraid to die? And I always say, well, I'm not afraid to die, but I'm not excited about it.
Right.
You can be death positive and still not really want to die yet.
Want
I don't want to die yet. I've got, grandkids that are, I want to watch them grow up, and I've got things, I just retired. I got things I want to do, but also I know I have no control over it. It's going to happen at some point. And when it does, if I am fortunate enough to have some kind of disease that takes me out where I'm on hospice and not killed in a car accident or something, I will be, I will know the things that are important to me that I want to do during that time, like I'm not going to be like pussyfooting around with people. I'm going to be like, yep, I'm dying. This is what, let's have these really important conversations. You can have so much regret around death if you don't say what you wanted to say to somebody, when you're
Absolutely.
dying, if you
That's a
don't.
huge regret. A lot of people have, oh, I wish I
Oh
had
yeah.
talked to them more or told them this or
Yeah.
ask them. I remember when my grandfather died. I was only 9, but I was like, oh my God, there's so many things I wish I had asked him. Like,
Yes.
when I
Yeah.
was so my high school years were bookended with two disease diagnoses, Crohn's disease my freshman year, and brain cancer my senior year of high school.
Oh my
And
gosh.
one thing, not just those, but throughout my life, that's got me through is my sense of humor. And I'm wondering how much a sense of humor plays in your job or dealing with people, even though they're so close to death, are they still laughing?
Yes. Yeah. Have you
Yeah.
seen my TikToks? There's a
Exactly.
reason. There's a reason why I use humor when I'm teaching about death on social media, because it is something that is a great coping mechanism. And I've had many, many people who were on hospice dying who made jokes, laughed about it, joked about it, and their families too. It's definitely something that it's just, I don't know. There's something that's like, it makes it more of a human experience for us to be able to. And I've always been like that. Anytime I am getting surgery or any kind of anything, I'm always joking about it. It does help you to cope. So yeah, it's, and I would not be doing what I do, educating in the manner that I do on TikTok with the humor, if I had not experienced that firsthand with patients and families for years and years and years, seeing that so many people cope that way and that it's really, really effective.
Do you have any patients that come to mind when you think of funny stories or funny things that happened or?
Not really. I don't really have any of that. People ask me that, and I'm always like, oh, because you're just. When you're with somebody like that, when you're with them, you're just so present in the moment that it's hard to like, I never wrote things down about, like, oh, you said this, that was so funny, but I've definitely have had those situations where patients like really cracked me up. I just can't remember specifically things
Way
that
more
were
humor than
said.
your ER experience, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Yes, definitely. The ER is not a, no, there's no humor in the ER. It's not a fun place to work at all.
Did something happen that told you it was time to retire, or was it because it was 20 years, or what? How'd that
Yeah,
come about?
well, a couple things. So I stepped away from the bedside several years ago and started working in a hospice quality position. So Medicare requires that hospices have a robust quality assurance program. And I worked in Seattle and the traffic was horrible. And I heard about this position in quality that was going to be virtual, part-time virtual, like I wouldn't have to be driving all over the place stuck in traffic. I just have to go into the office like 2 days a week. And so I thought, well, I've been doing this for a really long time. I'm gonna like move into this quality position. I also am the type of person that wants to learn everything I can about every aspect of something. And
Right.
so it enabled me to learn about the Medicare regulations, you know, the quality to educate others. I also was the e educator for a while too, so I taught other nurses. And then during the pandemic, we be became completely virtual and sold our house and moved to the cabin. So we live off the grid. At that time, we had an outhouse. We were hauling water to shower. We're, you know, like we, yeah, it's, we have an indoor plumbing now as of a couple of years ago. But it was a lot of work to live off the grid. And I was getting to the point too where I financially, the social media was working out well for me and taking a lot of my time. Like it's like a full-time job to be an influencer. It's very, very time consuming. And
Yeah, because you're editing, you're doing
yeah,
those things. Yeah,
editing,
you're making
filming,
sure it
like
looks good and all that stuff. Yeah.
yeah, a 90-second video can take me an hour and a half, 90 minutes to make with
Do
the
you have
finishing.
like 800,000 followers on Facebook? How many do you have on TikTok? Is that your biggest?
950,000.
On TikTok?
Yeah.
And how many on Instagram? Are you on you're on Instagram, I think.
Getting close to
And that
500,000 on
so that's the lead.
Instagram.
So it's like TikTok's the biggest, then Facebook, then Insta.
And then YouTube is
Okay.
276,000.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wait,
So it's a
so what
lot
was that like when your first like video went viral and you got all those followers? Were you just shocked? I mean,
Oh.
because that's you were not doing it to get go viral. You just
No, I
yeah.
wasn't doing it to get followers. So,
Right.
funny story. So, back during my second marriage, when I decided to go to nursing school, my husband was deployed. And, he, you know, him being military, we had like a stable income, and it was just enough to where I didn't qualify for financial aid, but not so much that it was, you know, like easy for
Of
me to
course,
pay for
they always want to
school.
make it hard, right?
Yeah. So this was like back in 2000, I don't know, 2002 or something like that. And I had heard about this chick, Karen, Save Karen. She started a website called Save Karen to raise money for her credit card debt. She was a shopaholic. And I heard about this and I thought, well, gosh, you know, like I'm going to nursing school. That's more noble. I should start a website. So I did. And it became an it. Went viral for the time back then. So there was no social media back then.
Right,
There
right,
was
right.
no GoFundMe. There was,
Right.
you know, nothing like that. And so I set up a PayPal and I was blogging and I said, and it was called Help Me Leave My Husband. And I explained that we had agreed to get a divorce and that I was trying to raise money for nursing school. I didn't want to go on welfare. I wanted to, you know, like nursing school. And so it became like world famous or infamous, you could say. I was on The View. I was on The Other Half. I
Oh
was
my
on,
God.
yeah, I was on Fox National News. I did like radio interviews with radio stations all over the world in the
That must have been
UK.
a whirlwind, like
Yeah. Well, the funny thing was, so I hadn't told my husband about it. So at first, I was, because he was deployed and he was special forces, so I didn't even know where he
Figure.
was.
Right.
So at first, I was like only doing this stuff like in the shadows, you know, don't show my face, don't say who I am, using my maiden name. And then I finally told him about it when he came home. And at first, he was mad, and then he was cool. And he was like, oh, okay, well, if you can earn some money, that will be good. And I only made about $3,000, but it really held me accountable for getting myself through nursing school because people were writing with encouragement, you know, and I'm
The
blogging and
View
everything.
host didn't cut you a check? Oh,
No,
come on.
they flew me to New York.
They
Not
could
only
have paid
that,
for
but I
that like
forgot.
that.
I forgot to mention the name of my website. And after the fact, I was like, oh crap, I never said it. And I wrote to the producer and I said, can you like put that
Put it
on there?
on.
Like, and they wouldn't do it.
Oh.
So yeah, it was annoying
I
because,
that's got to be a sign of the times too, because now
yeah.
that would be the first thing they mentioned
Oh
probably, right?
yeah, your
That's
website would be
so,
the yeah, but
yeah.
at that in those days, there just wasn't that much going on. But so anyway, related to the TikTok thing,
Yeah.
the first thing was like, holy shit, I did it again. My husband doesn't know about it. My employer doesn't know about it. Oh my God, what am I gonna do? And so I told my husband, right away. And then I disclosed it to our risk department. I said, look, I got a TikTok and it went viral. And now I've got 10,000 followers and I just want to tell you about it. And I wasn't telling any private information. In fact, the patient that I talked about was from a different agency that I worked for years ago. And they were like, they looked at my TikTok and they were like, yeah, it's fine. You can do it. So.
That was a
Yeah,
relief, I'm
it
sure.
was fine. Yeah.
And then it went from 10,000 all the way up to
Yeah.
700.
And in about a year was about, in about a, well, it wasn't even a year because I had 100,000 followers by October. I
Wow.
started in like May of 2020, and by October I had 100,000 followers.
What's your most watched video? How many views does it have? Do you know?
Probably about. Well, I recently had one on Instagram that has over 6 million views on it.
Whoa, does that just blow your mind? Like, I can't, like,
Yeah,
that's blowing my
I got
mind.
it like
Not
I
my
got like
video.
30,000 followers in a couple of weeks just from that
Wow.
video. I
Do you
was
get
just like,
notifications for every follower, or you just see the number go up? I was gonna
no.
say,
All my notifications are off on
that's good.
everything because I get to I have my daughter has to take care of the She manages my DMs on
Yeah, I was gonna say,
Instagram.
you don't read the comments or anything, do you? I hope.
I do sometimes. I mean,
Yeah.
it just, I kind of, it depends on what kind of
Because
mood
there's
I'm in.
always jerks out there, I'm sure, right?
Oh yeah. I block a lot of Facebook is the worst. So Facebook
Yeah,
is the
of course.
best for monetization. They're my bread and butter, but also that's where the meanest people are in the comments. But when I do a Facebook Live, for some reason, people are that so nice on Facebook Lives.
I'm wondering if, because those comments aren't real people. They're bots
Might
that
be.
are put
Well,
there to cause controversy. And when you're live, you know it's an actual person, and generally people are nice. I
I
bet
think
that
there
has
are
some.
bots, but also there's a group on Facebook called Murdered by Hospice. And they hate hospice and they hate me. And they have posted my videos on there. On their site to
Are
just
they
like
talking about assisted death? Like, what are they? Do they think that's what
they
you're
are
doing? What are they?
people, they're people who had somebody on hospice who died and they blame hospice for killing them. And most of the people that are on that group, and there's like 4,000 people in that group, seem to be people who did not have the legal decision-making authority for their person. And
So they didn't
that's
want him
there's
on
your
hospice. They didn't
sign,
want him
right?
on a
That's
hospice.
why,
Yeah.
because they would have made the wrong decision. Like these are people that think that their person would have lasted forever. Like they'd still be alive if it wasn't for hospice. They call
I
it
mean, do they
stealth
realize what
legal.
the, by definition, hospice means? You're about to die. They don't.
Well, hospice is I don't remember the exact definition, but
Yeah.
it does by hospice does mean you're dying. Like in
Yeah,
the
right.
US, hospice means you're going to die.
You're done.
Anywhere in the world, hospice means there's an expectation that you're going to die soon. Like we're all going to die,
Right.
but we're all dying. That's what we're getting old is. But in the US, hospice means that you have a life expectancy of 6 months or less and a terminal condition. So, yeah, people go on hospice because they're dying. They don't die because they go on hospice.
Of course. Like, we had, so I worked for 10 years at this house called Hope Lodge. They're actually all over the country for cancer patients. It's run by the American Cancer Society. And I had a guest there who was getting towards the end, and she would use psilocybin and DMT. What do you think about those for people that are on their way out? And for people
I
that
think
don't
it's
know, psilocybin is like magic mushrooms and DMT. I forget the molecule DMT stands
for. Dimethylmethane something or other. I talk about that in my book, actually.
Okay.
That, because whenever I do deathbed vision stories on TikTok or any social media, people will in the comments say, it's DMT, it's not real. And so I actually talk about DMT in my book. And I don't think that DMT being something that could be present in our brain and deathbed visions being actual visions of spirits are mutually exclusive.
Right.
I think that we could have DMT in our brain, and that's what allows us to see those spirits, you know.
True.
But I'm all for it. And ketamine is something that people are starting to, we use ketamine in hospice for pain management, but people are starting to use it for psychedelic
depression, I think, right?
Yeah, depression, but also at end of life. There's more and more like studies being done on this. And in fact, so I have a podcast also, it's called Death Happens, an Insider's Guide to Dying. And my hospice social worker partner and I interviewed somebody who does do that kind of counseling with the psychedelics for hospice patients. I mean, I'm all for anything that helps to bring people peace and comfort at the end of their life. I'm all for medical aid in dying. I absolutely wish it was a federally legal, you know, because I think people should have choice at the end of their life. I would love to say hospice makes death perfect for every patient, but that is not true. That would be a lie. Sometimes people have existential suffering and you can't treat that with anything.
Right.
Like, we sedate people when they're terminally agitated because they have existential suffering. We have to sedate them until their death. And so what's the difference
for your own safety, for your own safety? I'm sure. Right. If they're,
well, they're not able to like harm other people, but they're a harm to themselves because they keep trying to get up and they fall and they hurt themselves. And it's exhausting for the caregivers, you know, to have to experience this. It's, you know, my neighbor's husband recently died and he had terminal agitation. And she said it was just traumatizing for her because she was giving him so many medications and it took so much for him to finally be able to fall asleep. And when somebody's that agitated and restless, they can't die. They can't settle in and die. They're just too all over the place, you know?
So back to the, you know, talking about that you think psychedelics should be legal, assisted death should be, I don't know what the official term of assisted death is now.
It's medical aid in dying is what we try to go.
And you wonder how many
death with dignity in some places, you know? But people used to call it physician assisted suicide.
Right,
and that's an absolute no-no.
No, you don't call that enough.
Do not call it that.
I wonder how many of those lawmakers have had any experience with either these psychedelics or someone being in hospice care. My guess is zero.
Zero.
Yet they're making the decisions for everyone else that without that.
It's kind of like a lot of other healthcare decisions.
So sad.
Yeah. Yes.
Any other highlights from your book or themes from your book that you might want, I don't want to give away the whole thing, but like, what was like when you said, okay, I'm going to write a book, were you just like, all right, I'm going to write all my stories. I'm going to write, or is it my memoir from my beginning of my life all the way to the present? Is it more like that format?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it's mostly, stories about my patients and caring for dying people intermingled with my own personal story.
Right.
But yeah, I do start off with kind of like, you know, mostly like how I was bullied when I was in school and just kind of the things that helped to build my character, really. It's, you know, because people like to say hospice nurses are angels. And
I said heroic.
Yeah, you said heroic, but a lot of people say angels, and those of us who work in hospice don't feel that way at all. I'm not the only person who has a past like my past and became a hospice nurse. There's something about us going through that stuff that allows us to be a better hospice nurse, you know. I don't judge people for where they live or who they are, because there, but for the grace of God go I, right? That was me too. And just also being able to going through so much shit and then coming out of it and just having the strong shoulders to, you know, carry the burden of taking care of dying people every day. And not everybody can do that. And I've worked with nurses who couldn't do it. They couldn't do it. They just like me being in the ER, I couldn't do it. I didn't want to do it.
You every, know, it I like, mean, every profession has someone that shouldn't be doing it, whether you're talking about nurses or cops or teachers or priests, there's always the people that shouldn't be doing the job.
Yeah.
Right?
Priests especially. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, it's got kind of a mix of, it goes back and forth a little bit, and that was something that was important to me because I didn't want it to be chronological. Like, here's the whole part of my life, and now here get the hospice stuff at the end. It's really about.
Were there any parts that were really difficult to write? Were like the parts when you were wrote about when you were struggling? Were those hard at all to write about?
No, it wasn't, because I've moved past those things.
Yeah.
There's some stories that more of the taking care of dying people that kind of get me a little bit, like, you know, in fact, I was reading on, I sometimes will read from it on my TikTok, and I was reading one and it kind of grabbed me again. And it was a story about a patient that kind of went, oh, you know, like that. But my own past, like with my son and everything, writing about those things, I have been able to, and my book is about forgiveness too, you know, and I've been able to forgive those that hurt me, and I've been able to forgive myself many, many years ago. Because, you know, I just feel like I made up for that stuff. My son and I have a fantastic relationship now. He did come. So I started really seeing him more. I think he was about probably 7 maybe when I was going through treatment. Yeah, 6 or 7. And then by the time, so I was seeing him once in a while, I was still kind of getting my shit together after I got out of treatment. I'm sure you know how that goes. And then by the time he was 10 and I was dating my second husband, who was really, really good with kids, I started having him come over more and more. And then by the time he was in the 8th grade, he came to Japan and lived with me until he graduated from high school. And now he's just turned 40. Well, he's turning 42 in September.
Oh,
and yeah. And so, you know, like he and his family moved back to Washington State finally from Minnesota, you know. So, but I went and saw him every year in Minnesota. And then they have now moved back over, and he's in Western Washington. So I actually see him and my grandkids about once a month now. So like, we have a really, really great relationship. And it was almost, I feel like part of my ability to be able to forgive myself for abandoning him when he was a child is that I ended up rescuing him from a situation because his dad remarried someone who had a daughter the same age as Keith, my son, and she was horrible. I mean, she bullied him, and he, you know, just it was. And he is a very quiet, kind of a kind-hearted soul, you know.
Yeah.
And so it was hell for him to live in that situation. And his stepmother was really, really
on the other side of it. Sounds like
That's good. Yeah.
When you got all your followers and things went viral, did that affect people you work with or your family? Did you notice a change?
No, because I'm
that's
still
good.
Yeah, I'm still me. Like some people.
Well, I mean, I don't think it changed you, but did they?
No,
anyone?
No, but they know it's still.
They know
they're
you're
not.
Still
they're
you.
Like nonplussed about the whole thing. Right. Like, whoopie doo, you're famous on TikTok. I mean,
just
sometimes
made fun of you more than anything.
Yeah, kind of. But sometimes, like when I'm recognized in public, my kids think that's pretty cool. and my sister too. Like, we went on this nurse con cruise a few years ago together, and people were just like falling over me, and she got a kick out of that, you know.
People say
But for
nurse
the
Penny, or do they say hospice nurse Penny?
hospice nurse Penny, oh my God. Yeah. So they want pictures with me and stuff, you know. And so she got a kick out of that. My coworkers are mostly, you know, some of them are a little bit like fangirl a little bit, you
Yeah.
know, but those that I work with closely are just
Do you
kind of
sell merch? Do you have like shirts and stuff, or just your book?
no, just my book.
Okay.
I did
Just your book.
just my book. Yeah, just my book. I did somebody reached out to me recently and they want to do merch, and I'm thinking about maybe doing that, but I just haven't. I just retired like
I would get a
four
hospice nurse
days ago,
T-shirt
so
and
I'm still like
right, yeah.
trying to
So you gotta let things settle a little bit,
get my
right?
bearings, you know, and figure out like what's next for me. And actually, what's next is I spoke with a literary agent yesterday, and my podcast partner and I had already started writing a book called Death Happens:
Nice.
An Insider's Guide to Dying. So we're kind of like starting to think
Working on
about
that.
maybe see if we can get that published.
That's great. So, like, are you like any, if you could have any job or do anything, would it be podcasting, more books? Is it what you're doing now, or do you see?
Social media.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like
It's
writing the
here to
books.
stay, so I think you're safe
Yeah.
there.
Writing the books is fun, but I really like, if I could do anything, it would be to continue to educate about death and dying and normalizing death and dying on social media. And hopefully that will continue to pay the bills for me.
Would
You
you
know,
speak at like nursing schools? Like, have you done that, or would you do that? Have
I
I
have
asked
thought
you?
about doing that, and I always keep forgetting that I want to reach out to the local colleges and say, hey, I'd like to
Yeah,
speak.
I'm here.
I do keynote speeches, so that's something I really enjoy too. I just did one last month, and I've got one in September in San Antonio. So that's part of like the social media thing. But I mean, I'm basically
Making
doing,
appearances.
yeah.
That's
What I want to be doing is what I'm doing, and that's pretty cool.
Oh, I love that. I love
Yeah.
to hear that. We're coming up on an hour here. Is there anything else you want to add? Any other stories? Any other tidbits, advice? Where can we see your podcast? What is it on all the
It's on all the podcast platforms. Yeah, it's called Death Happens: An Insider's Guide to Dying. We've got two seasons out. We're just about to start recording again. I had to take a break from it because of the book
Right.
launch. I have a
That
website.
took energy. Wait a sec.
I have a website. It's hospicenursepenny.com, and I have events listed on there. So speeches that I'm doing, book signing events are on there. All the
Your book
information
again,
about, pardon me,
Influencing Death. Your book again is called Influencing Death.
Influencing Death, Reframing Dying for Better Living. Me on the cover with the ring light.
Love
That was my pink hair.
it.
Yeah, that all the information of where to buy that is on my website, but also it's just anywhere books are sold online. So Amazon, Audible. I did an audio version, recorded it myself, you know, did the narration on it.
Well, Hospice Nurse Penny, it's been an absolute pleasure. I can't thank you enough for coming and having a chat with me.
Yeah, thanks
And
for
I
having
wish
me
you the
on.
best in all your videos and your book and all that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Have a good one.
You too.